Lecture 16, Benefaction.
On a number of occasions in our series of lectures on Alexander the Great and the Hellenistic world, we've had occasion to talk about this concept of benefaction. On a number of occasions, we've seen particular Hellenistic kings acting as benefactors of certain states or of certain cities. And this concept of benefaction is one of the most crucial concepts and one of the most crucial institutions of Hellenistic life that I'd like to spend one of the lectures in this series discussing the origins of this institution. Where does it come from? What do the Greeks mean by this when they use the term euergetism or benefaction as it becomes in Latin? And what was its role in the survival of the cities of the Hellenistic world? There are a couple of key terms here that we must be familiar with. I've mentioned the term euergetism. This is merely a Greek expression which in Latin will become benefaction. It's an important term to understand, though, because it's often also the title of the Hellenistic king. Many of the kings, many of the Ptolemies and the Seleucids were known as Ptolemy Soter, Ptolemy Savior, or Ptolemy Euergetes, Ptolemy the benefactor. So it is an official title. It has a specific meaning in that range of titles that the Hellenistic kings come to have. And just as they liked to be called saviors or gods, this also is one of the most powerful terms in the vocabulary of politics and statecraft during the Hellenistic period. It was not an original institution, though, founded in the Hellenistic age. It has roots in the earlier periods of Greek history. In the classical age, the city-states of the Greek world had often operated with the help of an institution known as the liturgy. Now, when I use the term liturgy, there is obviously the opportunity for confusion because we use liturgy in English now to mean the words and the ritual practices associated with a religious event, the words of the Mass, for example. This is not what the term liturgy originally means in Greek. Rather, it refers to an undertaking, a task undertaken by a wealthy individual on behalf of his home state. And these liturgies, as they were called, these publicly undertaken tasks done for the benefit of the rest of the community, were very important in the classical world, particularly in classical Athens, as a way of establishing the status of the individuals involved. In the classical period, to put the matter at its most simple, cities such as Athens relied on the wealthiest citizens to pay for many of the city's annual expenses. Ancient cities didn't tax at the same rate or in the same way that we do in the modern world, so that ancient cities tended to have much lower revenues than contemporary states, and therefore were often in the position of being unable to afford the basic running expenses of the state for a particular year. In this way, by calling upon the wealthy to take on specific tasks for the state, the cities benefited by getting the wealth of the elite, and the leading members of society enhanced their position because instead of simply paying tax at a higher rate, as they may in the modern world, in this ancient system, they were in a position to enhance their own status by very public displays of spending on behalf of the community. So the ancient concept of the liturgy is an example of something we've seen elsewhere in the Hellenistic world of a set of reciprocal relations. You do something for me, and I do something for you. This system of expenditure in the classical world of liturgies undertaken on behalf of the public good was broken into various components. The best known of these liturgies was that of the choregos. Now, the choregos was responsible for producing the dramatic festivals held in honor of gods such as Dionysus, so that when the Athenians went to see their dramas, they didn't do it by simply turning on a TV or even just by buying a ticket for whatever was playing in the theater that night. Instead, they went to a religious event held at a specific time each year, and there they would see a set of plays held on the first day, another set of plays on the second day, and another set of plays on the third day. And each day's set of performances was paid for by one producer, as we would call him, using the contemporary analogy with Hollywood. This producer commissioned the playwright, he then paid the actors, and he purchased all the costumes and all the scenery that were used during the performance. So he was really responsible for every aspect of mounting the production. This is really something undertaken by the wealthy and the ambitious, because you get your name known as a result of doing this. One of the first public events involving Pericles, the man who in 5th century Athens will come to stand for the might of the Athenian Empire, is his performance as Choregos, his taking on of this public liturgy, in 472 when he paid for the production of Aeschylus' play, The Persae. So you advertise your arrival in Athenian politics as, say, a 30-year-old man, having done your military service and now moving into your maturity, by producing one of these plays, by spending your money for the benefit of the state. The other great example of a liturgy in the classical world prior to the Hellenistic period was that of the Triarchs. The Triarchs were men whose name means exactly commanders of triremes. Now, at one period in Greek history, these may have been the actual naval officers who ran the triremes, the ship captains, but during much of the classical period, the Triarchs rather were the men who paid for the upkeep of a ship. So, unlike our modern state, where our taxes are spent by the government to support all of our armed forces, in the Greek world, at least in Athens, individual men each year would take on the duty of paying for the upkeep of a boat, if it was too badly damaged, paying for its complete replacement, paying for all the tackle that needed to be used every year, the sails and the ropes, the spars that had to be brought from Macedon or from other parts of the Greek world, and they paid also for the crew. So the boat was kept seaworthy and the crew was paid, and it was not done at state expense, but rather it was done by individuals. Now, I explain this in some detail, even though this all refers to the period before the Hellenistic age, because I want to establish here the groundwork. This is the institution that the Greeks understand. However, while in the 5th century this system operated on a regular annual basis, in the 4th century in the Greek world it began to break down. And states began to find it harder and harder to fill the ranks of what can be called the liturgical class, the ranks of the super rich, the men who can take on these jobs every year. And it's that breakdown in the 4th century that really leads us into the Hellenistic period and the informal institution that replaces that of liturgies. Instead of there being definite tasks which must be assigned on a yearly basis to a certain group of men, in the Hellenistic age, what happens is that ad hoc arrangements replace the liturgical system. And in these ad hoc arrangements, the super rich, a very narrowly defined elite at the very top echelon of society, emerges as the group who are wealthy enough and willing to act as the benefactors of the Greek states. And they do this not on a regular yearly basis, but as needed. Now, the term for such behavior is euergasia, benefaction. The title of such a person is a euergetes, a benefactor. And we've seen that it's a term used by a title used by many of the Hellenistic kings, but it isn't confined only to the kings. This system, in fact, operates at other levels of Greek society as well, and the title of euergetes, or benefactor, can be conferred on an ambitious private individual who performs a function in the service of the state. And it really is, in some respects, the key institution that explains the arrangement of Hellenistic society, because it is fundamentally a hierarchical arrangement. It is based upon the vulnerability of the state and the community and their reliance on the goodwill and the willingness of the leading powers of the day, whether it be the ruling elite or the kings, to save the state. In a way, it allows Hellenistic communities to exist in a state of almost permanent crisis, always relying upon the goodwill and the generosity of some merchant or some king or some other benefactor. And I think that the prevalence of this institution, because it can be attested throughout the Hellenistic world at all times, points to a widening gap in the Hellenistic age, a widening gap between the community as a whole and the very few powerful men on whom these communities relied for their survival. So I think in the prevalence of euergasia, or benefaction, we see a major feature of the Hellenistic age which we can compare with the earlier classical Greek world. The Greek world had been moving in places like Athens towards democracy. We would not see democracy on a grand scale in the Hellenistic world, but we would see local autonomy, where individual communities could continue to act democratically if that's what their local set of laws dictated. But there is a new level of power that exists above any individual city, and that is the power of the benefactors. These men, whether they be kings or merchants, who can really determine the fate of a city. Because, as is going to become apparent from some of the documents we'll look at, if a benefactor does not step in to save the city will essentially die. So I think that the scale of the Hellenistic world and the scale of economy is not merely one that's geographically spread out, but one where we see far greater gaps or far greater distances between the vast majority of people and the few wealthy on whom society relied for its continuous existence. Benefactions could come in a variety of services and gifts. Some states received public buildings, particularly places like Athens, and particularly the great religious sanctuaries were given wonderful stoas where people could move away from the hot sun and could get protection from the rain, and where they could set up their shops, or new temples, or new theatres. These are some of the most popular benefactions. But these are the ones that tend to be given by the kings as ways of advertising their power. What the cities often need is something actually more practical to survive. For example, shipments of grain. The Hellenistic cities often suffered from grain shortages as grain was brought in from increasingly greater distances, as cities grew and it became harder and harder for them to feed themselves. And at times they would rely upon the goodwill of a benefactor to actually divert a shipment of grain to their city so that people quite literally did not starve. New fortifications were regularly given by cities as they had to build higher and stronger walls as a result of the changes in the techniques of Hellenistic warfare. And a whole series, a whole slew of institutions now in the Hellenistic world not seen before this are paid for by benefactions. For example, cities now tend to build more and larger gymnasia where their young men can recreate and where they can take courses of lectures from professors. We also find in the Hellenistic age many cities establishing a public schooling system where teachers will be paid for on the public payroll. We even know of acting companies which at various times were operating in the red and needed to get assistance. Sounds very much like the modern age. We also know of public doctors, so that the Hellenistic world experienced public medicine rather than just private medicine for the first time. All of these institutions of civic life had to be paid for. It put an increasing burden on the states, and many of the towns were unable to meet their bills and so relied upon private benefactors to come in. We have particularly good evidence about this practice of euergetism from two cities located up on the Black Sea, Istria and Olbia. It's particularly ironic that Olbia ended up needing a wealthy man to support them, because Olbia had come into existence hundreds of years earlier as a Greek colony located in what we would now call the Ukraine, precisely because the region was so rich. And in fact, the name of the colony, Olbia, simply means wealthy. Yet by the Hellenistic period, it was often reduced to relying on one man to save it from going under. These two towns then have left us a rich legacy of public documents that tell us about the fate of the cities and their survival. In one inscription, the council and the assembly of the city of Istria record their gratitude to a private individual known as Hephaestion. A very suggestive name, since it's the same name as Alexander's best friend, but it's certainly not the same character by any means. The city had taken out a loan of 300 gold pieces, but for nearly 20 years, the people of Istria had been unable to repay either the loan or the interest, which of course kept accruing. And now the interest alone, because of the length of time that the debt was outstanding, amounted to 400 gold pieces. So the city was getting into worse and worse financial straits every year and had no prospect of either balancing its budget or meeting its financial demands. Hephaestion, one single individual, cancelled the interest altogether. The loan was owed to him. He simply cancelled the interest worth 400 gold pieces on condition that the principal be repaid over 2 years. So here we have an example of a city only being able to balance its entire budget because of the generosity of the one man from whom they had borrowed money in the first case, in the first place, excuse me. In another instance, the people of Istria were suffering from raids by marauding Thracians, people from further north, and these Thracians had driven off their flocks. It was a benefactor by the name of Agathocles who served in a number of capacities helping the people of Istria in their dealings with these marauding Thracians. For example, he served as an ambassador to them. He paid the Thracian nomads to leave the city alone, and then when these marauders broke their word, it was Agathocles who went after them in battle. Let me read you some of the inscription. One of the remarkable features of this is that this inscription as we have it, and it is not complete, is well over 60 lines long. So that inscriptions are getting longer and longer in the Hellenistic world. They also are getting inflated just like everything else as you go into more and more detail. It must have been hellish for the stonemason who was cutting this, but it's excellent for us because we get such detailed information about the events of the day. So this inscription talks about when the city was in a state of confusion and a large number of Thracian pirates were attacking the land and the city, and the harvest was imminent and the citizens were in distress. Our man, Agathocles, was elected commander of the archers, and he took with him mercenaries, he paid for more troops, and protected the land and enabled the citizens to gather in the crops without harm. So he leads the force that protects the locals. And when the Thracians under King Zoltes came with a larger force to Scythia and the Greek cities under the rule of King Rimaxus, Agathocles was elected ambassador, and he travelled across enemy territory, passing through many tribes without avoiding any danger, and persuaded the barbarians not only to do not to do any harm to our city, but even to give back the flocks that they had previously stolen. And then the city actually pays over a certain amount of money to this King Zoltes to prevent the deprivations going any further. So they've paid off these marauders to get some security. But what happens? Well, the marauders come back for more. And so this time, Agathocles, when the Thracians broke their oath and agreement and made continuous raids, Agathocles was elected by the people general over the land with full powers and took volunteer troops from among the citizens and the barbarians who had taken refuge in the city. And so it goes on with further instances of his benefactions to the city. The entire city here is relying on the goodwill of one man. It's very interesting that at one point in the inscription they say he is made commander with full powers. He's almost being made a dictator or a tyrant over the city. The city is so incapable of defending itself that it must almost hand over supreme power to this one man, Agathocles. The city of Olbia, further north in the Ukraine, also gives us a very full account of the career of a typical benefactor, a man by the name of Protogenes, whose name originally means the firstborn and was clearly a man of substance and importance. The inscription that records his involvement in the affairs of the city is even longer than the one we've just looked at. It goes to over 200 lines, and once again it gives very precise detail of the way in which he stepped in to save the city in times of crisis. Three times the city was bankrupt. It had simply run out of money. And on these occasions, he gives 900 gold pieces to a local chieftain by the name of Cytopherenes, who is raiding the city. The city is bankrupt because it's been paying off these nomads, trying to give them money if they will leave their flocks alone. But This doesn't succeed. Each time they come back, they get paid more money, and eventually the city has no money left, and they still have these nomads on their doorstep, ready to sack, plunder, pillage, and burn. One man then, Protogeni, steps forward and pays money to this local character. The city has gone into hock. It has actually pawned all of its sacred vessels in order to raise cash to give to Cytopherenes. And so it is Protogenes who actually buys back the sacred vessels and redeems them once they've been pawned. Twice the city gets interest-free loans from him when the city is facing starvation, and he pays for the grain out of his own pocket. And the city, still in debt because it owes money to various other people as well, he will then buy up the debt and simply cancel it altogether, forgiving the debt. So he saves the city from starvation. He saves the city from marauding nomads on their doorsteps. In time of war, he then spends 1,500 gold pieces out of his own money to restore the city's walls, its towers, and its gates. So this one man is responsible for its physical defense. And by the end of his long and illustrious career, Protogenes is owed by the city of Olbia 6,000 gold pieces, a debt which he promptly cancels. Would that the powers that be today would be so generous. Perhaps we should tell the IRS about this policy. Now, I think we must look at these documents with mixed feelings. On the one hand, it is laudable and wonderful that there were men willing to step forward to save the day and to step in these various vulnerable cities. But the fact that the cities were coming to rely on this illustrates, I think, a very dangerous reliance on the super rich. The decrees honoring these benefactors of the Hellenistic states provide some of our richest evidence for daily life in the Hellenistic age, and they also point quite clearly to a period of immense danger, of immense turmoil, when people must have been facing terrifying uncertainty every day. And I think it's worthwhile remembering this, given that we've already looked at the Hellenistic romances and the novels, which so often turn on a plot which involves some reversal of fortune when somebody suddenly is thrown from prosperity into destitution and slavery. These inscriptions, which are not literary documents, but rather are real productions of these cities, I think illustrate that those novels are reflecting the actual conditions of the time. Many people must have faced dreadful circumstances on a daily basis, and they had to rely on the goodwill of powerful individuals to step in. I think this also helps to account for the success of the Hellenistic kings in selling themselves as gods. People wanted to have someone powerful in their life. Some of the most dramatic evidence involving this vulnerability and the reliance on the powerful few comes from a set of inscriptions that deal with the phenomenon of piracy, which was endemic in the Hellenistic world and was found in all parts and at all times of the Hellenistic age. We have a particularly moving inscription that comes from the small island of Amorgos. It's just a dot in the Aegean Sea. But listen to this and try to imagine the situation that it's describing. The council and the people have resolved as a result of a motion. Since, when pirates made an incursion into the countryside at night and captured a total of more than 30 girls, women, and other people, both free and slave, and scuttled the ships in the harbour, and captured the ship of Doryus, in which they sailed off with their captives and the rest of their booty, when all this had happened, Hegesippus and Antipappus, who were themselves prisoners, persuaded Cyclidas, the captain of the pirates, to release the free persons and some of the freedmen and slaves, and volunteered to act as hostages on their behalf. This is really dramatic stuff. These men have been captured and they've said, look, we're very wealthy, we'll go as hostages, keep us, let the others go, and we'll eventually make sure that you get the money. And they showed great concern that none of the citizen women or men should be carried off as booty and be sold, nor suffer torture and hardship, and that no free person should perish. Thanks to these men, the prisoners were saved and returned home without suffering harm. And so the city goes on to vote a crown in honour of these benefactors. I find this a very powerful document to read because it reminds you that honoring people as benefactors wasn't something that you just did as empty rhetoric. Often there was a real sentiment of gratitude behind this because these men had really saved your life and the life of your community. In another instance, a benefactor might not only negotiate the release of people captured by a pirate, but he might even serve as an ambassador to one of the states that sponsored piracy. Here, once again, the Hellenistic world bears remarkable similarities to our own. We speak customarily of states that sponsor terrorism. The same sort of phenomenon existed in the Hellenistic world. Crete, the island of Crete, and Aetolia in northwestern Greece were notorious regions where pirates lived and from where they operated, as was the southern coast of Asia Minor in the area known as Cilicia. In fact, there's a very good survey being undertaken right now of that particular region, trying to reconstruct what the daily life of these pirate societies was like. In one case, we know of a certain man called Eumarodas of Cydonia, who was awarded a bronze statue in Athens because he'd ransomed Athenians who had been captured by pirates, and it then persuaded the Cretan pirates to leave the Athenians alone. So the Athenians actually got an exemption, if you will. If a Cretan boat coming from this particular port saw an Athenian boat, they'd say, right, you can go on through. Whereas if it was a Corinthian boat or a Samian boat, they would then capture it and take the people off. So these pirates weren't just one or two boats flying the Jolly Roger going around the eastern Mediterranean. These were often organized fleets of states' ships that preyed on both the ships and even the settlements of other places. And you could negotiate with them to actually buy a kind of exemption from them. Piracy, as I said, was endemic around the Mediterranean, and it was, of course, tied to the trade in slavery. This is how the Mediterranean kept up its supply of slaves, not just by breeding slaves, but by constantly allowing people to be captured like this and to be sold at the great slave markets as on the island of Delos. So it was an age in which people might truly be terrified that their circumstances in life could change, and this is reflected in the novels and, of course, also in the plays of a popular playwright such as Menander. And once again, as with the novels, the plays often involve someone being a free citizen of one city, going off to a festival and being captured by pirates and then being sold into slavery. As one of the characters in one of Menander's plays says, "Cheer up, my friend, the Sicyonian officer who has brought you is a good man and a rich man. You'll be well treated." Not much consolation if you really had fallen into the hands of slavers. The reality of the Hellenistic age, then, was that individual cities were far weaker than the kings who now ruled territories as large as all Greece put together. Cities often lacked the means to rebuild after earthquakes. They often lacked the means to restore their walls and to fend off outside attack. And because of this vulnerability, they relied more and more on benefactors to protect them. And because the goodwill of the king was so vital to their survival, cities also relied on benefactors to intercede with the powerful kings of the age. Now, we've already commented that many of these kingdoms had, between the king and the local communities, a network of bureaucrats, of local governors. Well, of course, these local governors then also end up being seen as benefactors because they can both help a city and intervene between a city and a king. One city of Asia Minor, for example, was sent a governor by one of the Attalid kings of Pergamum. His name was Coregas, and he proved to be a very valuable intermediary between the local population and the king back in Pergamum. We know from honors voted to him by the local population that he had negotiated the restoration of the city's ancestral constitution. What that means in practice is the city was left to govern itself. So provided they paid their taxes when necessary and didn't cause any disruption, they were left autonomous. Two, he restored the city's sacred precincts and arranged for royal subsidies to pay for the city's cults. So the city was able to restore its temples and its altars, and it even got money from the king in Pergamum to help operate its religious festivities. Three, he himself, out of his own pocket, paid for the beasties that were then sacrificed at these annual festivals. And he also convinced, number four, he convinced the king to extend a tax exemption for the city from 3 to 5 years, so that the city not only was getting money coming in from the king in Pergamon, but not having to pay it out. And then finally he arranged for the royal treasury to purchase private property to give back to indigent citizens. So all of the institutions which in our world are really incorporated into the state are really here relying on the goodwill of individuals. Benefaction, as a result, has to be seen as one of the most important and characteristic public institutions characterizing the Hellenistic age.